Augmenters. Today, we are here to talk about creating community and belonging through mentoring. I'm Julie.
And I'm Jimmy.
And on today's show, we welcome the incredible Linda Villarosa. Linda is a journalist, professor, and the author of the book, Under the Skin, The Hidden Toll of Racism on American Lives and the Health of Our Nation. She brings her intuitive questions into all kinds of communities across the country and the globe. And today, you will hear Linda's behind-the-scenes stories, as well as her words of wisdom for early career journalists.
We are excited for you to hear what we learned. Augmenters, here we go.
Linda Villarosa, we are so happy to have you on Augmenters with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, and honestly, Linda, you hold many amazing titles and roles. You've done some incredible things. You are not famous for being also my neighbor and somebody that I've always admired. And we always see each other walking up and down the block with our dogs who kind of growl at each other, but at least we always smile at each other. But that is not the thing you're most famous for, of course, although we do love that you live in Brooklyn. But you are the author of Under the Skin, The Hidden Toll on Racism on American Lives and the Health of Our Nation. You are a journalist in residence at the Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at CUNY. You're a contributing writer for the New York Times. You speak, you educate, and we assume you mentor. Is that true?
That's very true. Mentoring has been a big part of my life and career, going in both directions.
Tell us more.
At my first real job was at Essence Magazine. I started there in the late 80s, and Susan Taylor was my mentor. She was the editor-in-chief, and she gave me my first big story, which was about HIV/AIDS. And I was surprised to be getting that article, that assignment, because I was basically the sort of a health and fitness person, not a serious public health writer. I later found out a number of people turned down the assignment, so I wasn't the first choice, but still I was a choice. I later had my first, in 2017, I had my first New York Times Magazine cover story on the same topic. And it was interesting to think, if I hadn't have gotten that chance from her, who believed in me, I wouldn't have, you know, sort of fast forwarded decades to still be writing about that topic on a different, bigger platform.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Was there any specific advice Susan gave you? Were there any kind of words of wisdom? How did she sort of inspire you or share her what she saw in you?
I think that in some mentoring relationships, and in this one, we were very different. So we were complementary. I was a person who was kind of awkward, felt like I didn't always fit in, but was really intellectually smart. And that was my comfort zone. She was someone who was very wise and had sort of good instincts and was also really smart, but felt insecure sometimes in the academic arena because she hadn't gotten her college degree. So I think we fit in really well, where I could be her little smart person all the time. And she could be the person who said, you know, I don't care if you're a little awkward. I trust you and believe in you and need you. And I think that was a really good relationship that we had for a long time. And it made me work really hard for her. It made her lift me up and boost me and sort of have me be able to get promoted, make friends because of her belief in me.
I love it, Linda. This is the complementary mentor, and, you know, where, you know, one plus one fits in a wonderful Tetris way to equal more than two. Do you still remember? Because it's pretty cool to think that, you said, you know, decades after you first got assigned the story, you then were on the New York Times cover with what you were writing. Do you remember any of your mentor's words from that first assignment? Like, was anything still ringing in your ear as you were writing what became the cover story?
I think it was just the feeling that I got this cover story, you know, that I got the first article in the first place. And then really, I never think of my current editor, Jessica Lustig at the New York Times Magazine, as a mentor. But now that we're having this conversation, I think she also believed in me. She hadn't I hadn't ever written for the New York Times Magazine, much less gotten a cover story. And I think she also believed in me and pushed me to go harder. When I first, that story ended up being a very important magazine story and story in general about HIV/AIDS in the South among Black queer men and trans women in 2017. And I wanted to do a simpler story. And she pushed me and she said, you can do more. You can do better. You need to go and see whose fault this is, not just the happy part of it, which was what I was centering. And I like being pushed and was surprised. And I thought, how does she know I can even do that? So I think that I work well when someone believes in me.
I love that. I love that. And that is it's always kind of one of our first questions and our ways that we get to know our guests is, you know, who believed in you before you believed in yourself? But clearly you had this amazing ability inside of you, and just having that opportunity to have somebody see that in you and give you the opportunity, right, to continue to like grow and to push you a little bit. And I think a lot of what we talk about with mentoring too is like, it's your job to kind of help push. It's not your job to just agree and just say, that's nice. And isn't that great? That's part of your job, is to ask tough questions and to push. Do you currently mentor others, and do you mentor young journalists?
I have over the years mentored a lot of young journalists, and currently I mentor a lot of people. People now approach me about, they don't necessarily say, will you be my mentor? But sometimes they do. And sometimes I don't know them. Sometimes other people suggest you write in the same wheelhouse, or you work in the same sort of space that Linda works in, and call her. She's nice. Ask her questions, ask her to be your mentor. So I get that a lot. I had a student from Morgan State call me, email first, and then call. We had a conversation out of the blue. And it was so interesting. I was like, oh, I never would have thought to call someone and say, will you be my mentor? I love her. She is doing great work and wonderful.
Shout out Baltimore.
Yes, exactly. And I think that just happens a lot. I have a lot of students who stick with me after the class is over. And I teach at the Craig Newmark School of Journalism and City College, undergrad at City College, graduate school in the journalism school. And I have students who have been with me a very long time, who sometimes it's just a check-in. Sometimes it's, I actually need help on this project. And I spend a lot of time on that because I know the importance of having someone believe in you. I know the importance of getting help. I'm mentoring a student at Harvard Medical School right now, and he's going to be a doctor, but he wants to write his memoir. We were just on the phone yesterday, and I had a really long conversation about his work. And at first I was like, ooh, I'm going to have to spend a lot of time with this guy, because being a doctor doesn't naturally mean you're going to be a good writer.
A memoir writer?
Exactly. But I believe in him. And yesterday I recommended other books that he should read. And we had a long conversation about the power of reading other people's work, but not getting intimidated by it. And it was really wonderful.
Yeah, I can imagine you have a lot of people who would love to get some time with you. How do you balance that? Because you can't really mentor everybody. Is there something in particular that you look for in those people that you really take in?
I look for people who are going to get the work done, who are not just talking about it, but who are actually have some kind of plan to finish it. And I have a funny person that I'm mentoring now who's writing her biography, and she's quite a bit older than me, and her, you know, because she's in her 70s, her story is very complicated. I told her, I think you should break off part of what you want to write and write an essay to make sure you're really going to do this. And she sent me the essay today. It got published in The Guardian today. It's about seniors and it's about seniors and gambling, and about how when the Super Bowl comes, that senior gambling picks up. And she's a psychologist and a really good writer, but I just wanted to make sure she was going to finish, and she had the gumption to push ahead and to, if you're going to find an agent, you'll be able to find an editor, and you need to do these things to push yourself into the world. And she did it. She sent it to me today, and I was so happy, but I am her mentor.
That's amazing. So do you find that is like one of your kind of tricks for yourself to prioritize your time by giving smaller tasks, like kind of chunking out the big goal and saying, hey, if you're able to get this piece done, then I know it's going to be fun and productive for me to stay involved in our relationship?
Oh, that is exactly right. And I'm one of those people, I can sort of sniff out someone who's all talk and no walk. And I really don't, I don't like that. I like people who get things done and who are committed to their projects, not just talking about. I said to someone recently, I said, well, a lot of people have ideas. All of us have ideas. You should have so many ideas that you're willing to give ideas away. Those are not my words. They're Deanna Vreeland, the famous fashion editor. And so ideas are great, but do you have a plan? Are you really going to get this done? Are you going to stick by it? Those are the people that I like to mentor.
Yeah, it's hard, right? It's hard. There are so many ideas and there's so many priorities too. I think that's hard, especially people like all of us who have a variety of different things that we do. We don't just do one job. You're always, you know, kind of pulling together new projects and different things. So I think I love that. Like, let's start with something small and let's see you, you know, make that happen. And then we can kind of keep going from there. I'd love to talk a little bit about community and belonging, if that's okay. We've been talking a lot about that as it relates to mentoring. I know a lot of your work is focused on health equity, the health system. I'm curious your take on how emotional health or connected relationships, connected communities, if you see any connection between kind of our physical health as humans and our emotional connection with others.
I think that is very important. And most of my stories that I work on, I see that the people who are like, if there's an affected community or an affected group, I did a story about environmental justice and environmental racism. And what I was most, what I did not know at the beginning, but what I was later found out was how important the activist group on the ground was and that they were intergenerational. My favorite story about them was, it was, the group was started, it was called Philly Thrive, by this young white woman who had gone to Swarthmore. Then she moves to Philly and she realizes there's this huge problem around environmental justice because of a refinery. And what she did was she organized the people who were living on the fence line of the refinery. So I, when I first went in and I did my first interview with her, I was asking her about her work and how she got connected to this community. And I remember that she was getting a little insulted. She was like, well, I'm not Erin Brockovich in this story. I said, well, okay, I would never be writing about that. I look at the rest of my work. Then she introduced me to the other people, and most of them were older Black people. And I said to her, all right, how did you get involved with them? And she would call them Miss So-and-so, Miss. And that's an old school, you know, you do not call an older Black person by their first name only. So she knew not to do that. And she said, well, I went to church with these people, with the people. I went to the community dance. They have an oldies dance on Wednesdays in the park. I went there. She showed me a video of herself, this young white woman, all these older Black folk. And my favorite moment in that was they all went wearing matching t-shirts and they were going to do a protest. So the young white woman and her friends were in the front. And then the older Black people were in the back because they were walking more slowly and one person was in a wheelchair and all the white kids wanted to get arrested. It was so clear. They were like, ooh, they're the cops. We want to get arrested. All the Black people were like, I don't want to get arrested. I know I'm not going to get arrested. And I realized that this is the perfect group and how much they supported each other. The speakers were a whole mix of this, you know, they held their microphone in front of the terrible refinery with the cops over here, and they all got a chance to speak. And their sense of belonging was really beautiful. They also ate together. They would have parties at the park together. They would meet together. And their meetings were really, what is the word? The meetings were really, there was a lot of sharing. There wasn't somebody hogging the stage. Everybody got a chance. And I just thought, this is why this activist group works, is because they have figured out how to share space and how to be with each other and how to be more than just the work, to socialize together. And I really, well, I took so long to write that story that I got to know them very well.
So how does, in all your kind of writing and stories, you know, when you're talking about becoming part of a new community, you know, sharing space is what everybody says, you know, sharing something that's beyond, as you said, like the work, like the little things, the day-to-day things. How much of that is realizing that if you want to be part of a community, it's not about you, but understanding like the people that are already there? How much of that is asking questions in your mind versus actually being like physically present? Is there a mix? Because a lot of people, I think, would like to be sharing and be part of other communities, but don't know how to comfortably jump in, comfortably support. And I guess jump's not the right word, but like slowly go from, you know, thinking about it to crawling to walking to be part of that community. Do you have any advice?
Yes. Well, as a journalist, what I do is I find someone who's willing to work with me to enter the community. But I also don't go anywhere. You know, I don't start reporting until I have visited the place, honestly, unless I'm on some really, really tight deadline. Once I couldn't visit because it was during COVID and I only had 3 weeks, but usually I have several months. So I will go to Jackson, Mississippi. I will go to New Orleans. I will go to Philly. And I need to, whether I'm walking around the community, doing research, doing historical research, I do all that before I ask one question or even meet one person. Then I find someone who is already part of the community doing work that we have sort of a win-win. By talking to me, they will gain something. And certainly I will gain something by getting an intro into the community. So sometimes it's a doula. Sometimes it's an activist. Sometimes it's a community health worker. So those are people who introduce me. Then I will, you know, kind of stick around that person, whether it's I say, can you drive me around to let me understand through your eyes what this community is like? Mm-hmm. So my reporting is very community-based and place-based before I even ask anyone a question. And I try to gain trust with one person first who can help me gain trust with a bigger group of people. And that's just worked well for me.
I come back to the quote that you said, which was all talk and no walk. You stay away from those people. And you begin with a community with all walk and no talk. You're physically there.
Journalists who talk too much are probably not that good at what they do.
I love it. I love it. It seems so simple, but as you kind of talked about, you know, not necessarily finding a champion, but finding your entree, building trust with one can then open up a much larger world. How do you stay connected once you are encouraged, once you are invited to be part of that community, once you see the eyes, or once you see the space through the eyes of the people that are living it? Do you stay connected at all, other than how it reverberates in your brain? Like, how do you keep track of the people or the themes or the goals of those groups?
Well, it was interesting in my maternal and infant mortality story. I mean, I was at the birth of this main subject's child. And I saw him recently. I think he just turned 6. And he ran up to me and gave me a big hug. And he recognizes my voice because I spent so much time with his pregnant mother. My voice is still familiar to him. And so I do keep in touch. It feels like since after I've established close relationships with the people that I cover as a human being, and I know I was, you know, as a journalism professor, I was like, well, you have to have some professional boundaries. And, you know, I remember one of my students raised their hand and, well, seems like you don't have very good boundaries. I said, oh, no, mine are terrible. But you should start out that way. Boundaries are not my strength, but I try to be honest and straightforward with people to say, we've established a relationship, but also remember that I am a journalist. We're not just talking. This is going someplace. And I hope that you trust me. And so I do stay in touch with a lot of the people that I've interviewed over the years and communities.
I was going to say, Linda, do you have the Philly story is incredible. And I can absolutely envision this young white woman dancing in the park with these older black people. And just like this, I can see the whole thing. Any other like of your favorite stories, like some of your favorite ones that you've covered or where you've really seen kind of communities coming together?
I think that HIV/AIDS, that first one, was really moving for me because I saw a group of people who had largely felt that they had been left behind because of the stigma of being gay, because of the stigma of having HIV/AIDS, and then to see them coming together. And they talked about each other as using family names, like somebody's the mother, someone's the dad, someone's the son or daughter. And I'm thinking they cannot be related because I didn't know so much of this language. Now I see it more in, you know, in ballroom, you see it, but I didn't know that language. And I saw this group of people who were really caring for each other because they felt that nobody else cared about them. But their communities were very tight-knit and their communities were strong. And they, you know, they're like regular families. They got in fights. They stopped speaking to each other. Then they'd mediate and then they'd get back together and they ate, you know, they had food together. I remember I got invited to a barbecue there and I had met most of the people and I had been reporting it. This is in Jackson, Mississippi. And I remember I said, well, I will help with the barbecue and I'll make the potato salad. So everyone's eyebrows shot up into their hairline because they're like, uh-oh, that woman from New York, our friend from New York is making the potato salad. I was like, honey, my family descended from this area. I grew up in Chicago for part of my life. I can make potato salad. My great aunt taught me, trust me, my potato salad rocked. It was great. But, you know, that again, that was part of the sort of building trust, getting to know people beyond just the, I'm the journalist sitting down to ask you questions. I'm also the person that comes to your barbecue. I also went out dancing with them. I don't like dancing that much, but I did. I went to the club and it was really important. They saw me and they're like, oh, you're here. I said, of course I'm here. I want to see, you've been talking about how fun the club is. So I want to come here too and see how fun it is.
Wow. You are amazing at, as you said, you don't have much for boundaries of, pushing yourself to enjoy an experience. You're giving me a lot of encouragement and energy to go out and try some things. So it's wonderful to hear you share. I kind of want to switch topics a little bit to your book, Under the Skin, and talk about the kind of differences in communities that you discuss. You know, you're talking about, you know, inequities in our healthcare system. Healthcare is our biggest industry in America, arguably, you know, tearing apart our country and separating people more than any other industry. And you're talking about one of the most basic root problems of this healthcare, sick care issue. And when you bring race into conversations, especially when it's supposed to be professional, it can really make people uncomfortable. But you needed to get information and I assume, you know, share space with both the providers and the folks that were getting, you know, disserved by the system. How did you find ways to kind of disarm folks that were immediately not comfortable, not ready to share about why decisions were made historically or why decisions right now are being made that are not providing equitable health care to all of our citizens?
I think that for me, it's an institutional question. It is not a question of individual human beings making mistakes, going into a profession that they're supposed to do no harm. But clearly, harm gets done to people. People are harmed by our current system. If you talk to providers, most of them don't like the current system, even though they work in it. And many are doing heroic work and really good work, but the system isn't working. And even for them, one of the early stories I did before my book, before I started writing for the magazine, was about physicians who get poor treatment from their colleagues, for their family members. And it turns out that I had read a kind of an obscure study about physicians complaining that their family members went in the system, they were not treated that well by people who should be their colleagues. And what I realized was they trusted the system more than most of us. Most of us, you know, if you're smart, you don't go in thinking, oh, everything's going to work out great for me. I can just throw myself, fall into the loving arms of the hectic healthcare system and these physicians, nurses, all the other people at the hospital system, or the care system. Most of us are a little skeptical. We go in thinking, oh, maybe I need someone to go with me. Oh, maybe I need someone to take notes for me. This is scary. I'm not sure if I trust. I need a second opinion. And for people of color, especially Black people, it's even more important. And I didn't go in thinking, oh, the healthcare system is really terrible right away. I had to go through and look at data. There's so much evidence of people. First, there's studies that say Black people especially get worse treatment, period. It's the 20th anniversary of unequal treatment, which is a huge deep dive into inequity in the healthcare system. It looks at 480 studies. One of them is about amputation. So it looked at people, two groups of patients, Black patients and white patients. They had the same severity of diabetes, and they also had the same kind of healthcare. So it was equal. Things were equal. Yet Black people were much more likely to get an amputation, even when everything else was equal. And that was, you know, I read those 480 some studies. That was the one that stuck with me. I don't think people go into the healthcare system, go to be doctors and surgeons and other kinds of providers to do evil. But somebody is making a decision to cut off Black people's legs and feet more often. And so I even looked into that more. I was like, why would that happen? And it had to do with compliance, the idea that I, the provider, am worried that you won't comply or you're not able to comply to this, to the less harsh treatment. So you're going to get the thing that's going to save your life, even though maybe there are other ways to save someone's life without giving this really life-altering treatment. And I think, you know, you have to think more deeply. It's not just this good versus evil. It's this more complicated question. So I'm very interested in what happens in the healthcare system. And I think I've looked at a lot of evidence. I was part of the 1619 project. So I was looking at it hundreds of years ago. But then, you know, I'm listening to people give their experiences, including healthcare providers giving their experience of being in the healthcare system / having family members in it. And it's not really working for anyone. And I think that's the important thing. And certainly I have been accused of blaming healthcare providers. So I've changed my own language around that to say, to be clear that I'm not going in, I'm not blaming you. I'm saying, let's look at a system that's broken. First of all, the access isn't good. We're one of the only, if not the only, developed country that does not have healthcare as a human right. But still, even if everyone had that, if the system that they're entering is not fair to people, then it's still broken.
Linda, that was an amazingly comprehensive answer. I'm going to try to simplify it for my brain, because what I heard was you actually using some like kind of classic negotiation techniques where you framed the problem and said, you know, this is not a people problem, it's a system problem when you're talking to providers. And then before getting into actual, you know, actions or specifics that are qualitative, you then said, then look at the data. So I heard you say, frame the problem, then look at the data, and continue in a way to ask why that an issue or a problem persisted until you could get down to the true causes, such as, you know, it came down to, in that diabetes study, it seemed that providers were concerned about compliance from the group of the people of color compared to white patients. And that way it removes, what I heard you say in so many words was, it removes potentially the barriers of sharing of the provider wanting to not give you the story, but give you the information to help everybody understand better why this system or whatever story you're working on wasn't working. I know that was a long way for me to go about it, but like frame the problem, look at the data and keep asking why. Do you have like a heuristic like that in your head that you think through as like, I'm going to do these couple steps when you start jumping into these like really messy and complicated, you know, stories?
I think instead of framing the problem, it's recognizing the problem and then looking to make sure it's a thing by examining data and asking people, kind of the data first for me, and then asking people to help me understand why this problem exists and what I'm missing. I think even when I've been thinking a lot about that first HIV story because I thought it was a different problem. I thought when I went down, I said, you know, I had to look at why would Jackson, Mississippi have the highest infection rate of Black queer people, infection rate of gay people. And then it's, you know, Jackson, Mississippi is the Deep South. So I'm thinking, okay, there's a lot of Black people there. And I thought it was a problem of lack of access to healthcare and also education, that people just didn't know in 2017 how to prevent getting infected with HIV/AIDS. Then I went there, and a lot of the people that I was interviewing were college educated or were in college. They were young people in college. And I said to one who had been newly diagnosed with HIV, I said, "Did you know how to avoid getting infected?" He said, "Oh, yes. Yes, I knew." And I said, "How did you know?" He said, "Oh, because of the problem here, we learned it in school." And I said, "What happened?" And he cried. And it was like one time. He had one time where he had unprotected sex. But when the infection rate is so high in a community, one time is much different and more, I'm using quotes, risky than in a different place because of the greater chance of becoming infected by someone else. And that's different from lack of access to education. And then I'm thinking, well, okay, lack of access to healthcare. Then I go there and I find that they have an amazing healthcare clinic, which is really state of the art. The people there are really nice. They know a lot about HIV. This is the poorest state in the country, but still they had figured out how to make the money work for them. They had this medical mall that was really quite innovative. But what they were lacking was not access to healthcare, but it was how to get to the healthcare system. Their transportation system was terrible. People were unemployed. So even if they were educated, they lacked employment. And then it was also stigma. So it was being stigmatized because of being gay there and later being HIV positive. So that is slightly different from what I thought. I kept going, oh, they just don't have, there's no one to help them or to show them, to teach them. And that wasn't it. It was these other barriers that were more subtle. And so it was an interesting story. That story has taught me, don't go in with a preconceived notion. Go in with your mind open. And even if you have the preconceived notion, know that you may be wrong.
Especially when it comes to communities and communities that you have perception of, but are not in the middle of, or have not had a chance to really get to know. And it's hard because it takes time, right? It takes time. And like, it takes time to get to know what's happening. And, you know, I feel like we're always under pressure to kind of get to the answer very quickly, but that's a great reminder of really asking those questions and getting in the middle of a community to really understand what's happening. Last kind of thing, and I think we could probably talk forever, but speaking of kind of systems that are broken, I feel like we could probably jump around to a lot of places with this. Higher education, of course, has its challenges at the moment, and journalism too. I know you work sort of at the intersection of both. Do you have any advice for new upcoming journalists or people who want to get into journalism, as you know, from an outside perspective, how it has shifted and evolved, and obviously, you know, the digital aspect and clickbait and, you know, all that. How do you keep young journalists inspired to keep telling these deep, truthful stories?
Well, I think I come at it from two different ways. The first one is, part one is to just learn to think like a journalist. So that means being curious, doing research, finding evidence, learning how to prove your points, and learning how to communicate, whether it's, you know, if you're on, you're doing a podcast, or you're a writer, or you're doing video or on television, video storytelling. Learn how to do the basics first to make sure that that's what you want to do. But anyone can benefit, whether you're a journalist or not, from knowing how to communicate and understanding how to think like journalists think. Then the next step is to think of, I find that the people who get the jobs aren't the ones necessarily who are the hungriest for the jobs at first. Because I say, get the skills first, make sure that this is what you want to do, and then get really hungry. Be the one who, I want to be an intern here. I will do the work. I'm calling up Linda Villarosa, and she is going to be my mentor now because of force of will. And because in this market, it's hard. I think it's easier if you're just starting out in some ways than it is if you're more seasoned and you're more expensive. I always tell my students that. I was like, okay, don't start panicking yet. First, try to get in. You're cheap. You're cheap now. And also, don't start being negative right away. I was in a faculty meeting at my school and we were trying to decide whether we should have this conversation with our students about, you know, that the business is hard, people are losing their jobs. And I said, no, let's keep them. They're not getting jobs yet. Let's keep them positive. Let's keep them fresh. Let's keep them hungry. Let's keep them working. Let's keep them learning. Let's keep their minds open. Also, I teach feature writing class and I was mentoring another feature writing professor who, because I only am there every other semester. So I said, if you're going to take over my class next semester, let's talk about how you would teach the class. And one of the first things he said was, I really want to teach the students how to get their pieces published. And I said, I don't do that. I teach them how to write the best piece that they can, do the best research, reporting, thoughtfulness, framing, revising, thinking visually, writing in a cinematic style. And then those are the pieces that will get published. Not to go first, oh, I just want to get published. Say, I want to do the best work I can. And that is what rises to the top. And then you can, you know, figure out where it should go. Just like my older mentor figured out that her piece should go into the Guardian. And yes. There it is. Right before
Super
Bowl.
I cannot wait to read it. I mean, I'm not quite a senior yet, but I feel like I'm going to get some tips, some betting tips.
And Julie does love to gamble.
So. I do it a little bit, just a little bit. Just a little bit. Okay. I love your optimism, Linda. I think it's because you're from Chicago. I'm also from Chicago. So I think we share that slight Midwestern optimism that does get beaten out of us living in New York for a while, but it does shine through.
That's right. And, you know, I credit Chicago. And then I also came of age in Denver, which is a very optimistic, outdoorsy. There's a beautiful connection to nature there that keeps, you know, that's how a lot of people ask, oh, you do those difficult stories. How do you keep yourself sane, emotionally healthy? And I was like, I love the out of doors. And I grew up that way. And that's important. And, you know, I have a really cute dog and really a great cute family and a wonderful partner. So
good kids. Great neighbors.
Great neighbors.
Linda, you just kind of blew me away with something that might have been so simple, but you said, like, don't teach how to get published. Teach people how to write work that should get published and it will get published. Again, it's coming back to, you know, don't talk about what you want to do. Just do it the right way. And then, you know, everything you want will come. It seems, you know, it's like the line of like making something simple, but not simplistic. And you just like doused me in that with that story. And I do a little bit of teaching myself and all the students want their business plans to get funded. And I don't talk about how to fund or get financing till like the second to last class. So, and I'm now thinking maybe I should just remove that fully because if the business plan is good enough, you know, they will get funded. You're totally right. They don't need to worry about it. You know,
That's really funny. I took an entrepreneurial journalism class and none of us knew anything about business, zero. And so we all had these ideas and we did this business plan with no thought of money. So our poor professor had to say, y'all, you people actually need to start with money because you have no idea of how you're going to make these great, you know, plans and ideas and, you know, big thoughts work. So we did the opposite and it was hilarious. All of us had to change our plans and our ideas and our goals because we had no grounding in business.
Interesting. See, what's funny is what you kind of laid out on like how you approach stories and communities is like the classic tried and true model of customer discovery to influence product development. And, you know, product development is the name of the game for any business to succeed. And if you can't listen to your customers, then you're never going to sell anything. So I'd love to read a business plan of yours because I bet it would be excellent and it would have customers at its core, which would be very exciting.
Yes. Well, that did help to do that, to say, oh, what do my customers want? And then also, what would they be willing to pay for?
Yeah. amen to that.
That's, that is very important. Yeah, that is very important.
Linda, if I could, I like to end with four rapid fire word associations. They're very easy, all on our topic here of augmentoring. And then I'd like to ask you about just a symbol question. And I don't mean like banging together and making a sound. So for rapid fire word association, what word comes to your mind when I say the word mentor?
Lead.
Lead. Mm. How about mentee?
Ooh, I wanted to say follow, but I'm not going to do that. Partner.
Oh, okay. I'll put a follow in parentheses for my notes. How about sponsor?
AA.
Sure. we want what comes to the brain.
The first one who said that. You're the first one who said that.
And lastly, coach?
Friend.
Friend. Hmm. Love that. We like to talk about and learn how best to, you know, engage in conversations that can be challenging and that makes people feel like they belong to a community, especially when these conversations are in a group. And we like to use the symbol of the book in book club. And that when most people go, though I bet you talk about the book, but when most people go to book club, they don't talk about the book as much as they just talk about how they're feeling and they really open up. And the book is really the unlock to have a much more deeper conversation about what's happening with the individuals in that group. Do you have any kind of unlocks that you like to use to be able to, you know, have a much more broad and comprehensive conversation, such as maybe, you know, proving that your potato salad is worthy of Jackson, Mississippi?
I think that what I do, I interview people, but I also interview a lot of scientists and researchers who know so much more than I do. I don't have any science background. And so what I ask is not about the work, but I ask, how did you get into the work? And that is super interesting because I would say 100% of the time, the people who are the best at their, as scientists, as researchers, are people who had some lived experience who brought them to the work. And I remember I was interviewing this cardiologist during COVID, and I said, tell me how you got into the work. And he started talking about, it was so beautiful. He started talking about growing up in New Orleans and how he went to the Zulu parade. It was one of during Mardi Gras. And I didn't tell him that the sort of the basis of this story was the sort of setting was Mardi Gras. And it was the Zulu crew, which was the black group that throws the best parade. And he started talking about this. And I was like, got chills. And he said that this really moved him because he saw this community of black people in New Orleans doing this thing together, you know, organizing the best parade. And then he knew that they had gotten COVID very quickly during the beginning of the pandemic. And I said, you probably didn't know this, but that's where I am centering this piece. And both of us were, he was like, oh, did you know I was from New Orleans? I said, no, you're based at Northwestern. I hadn't looked that deeply into you, but I often get that so I will ask the scientist, the expert, to say, tell me how you got into this work and start at the beginning. And they'll start. There was a woman who runs a really interesting asthma prevention program where she puts community health workers into people's homes in order to see, to reduce asthma triggers, whether it's a cat, dust, mold. And I said, so I asked her that question. It turns out, I think she grew up in North Carolina and her grandmother was a visiting nurse. And so she would go with, this woman's a physician, okay, at a huge, you know, wonderful teaching hospital in Philadelphia. But she said, I learned at my grandmother's side the importance of going into people's homes with kindness and respect, but also to see what's happening in the home before you start to say, oh, you need to get into the healthcare system. It's like, let me see how you're living. And that is how she ended up with this community health worker program that goes into people's homes. So I think that's really important to understand how people got into the work. And even me, when people ask me that, most of the people in my family are in, you know, they are mental health care folks. So my mother was trained as a social worker, my father, my sister, my godmother, and her daughter. So we grew up talking about people around the table. So that makes me comfortable as a journalist talking about people you know, your job in mental health is also asking questions, and my job is also asking questions, but I also bring, I think, a deeper sort of emotional understanding of people, not just, I'm going to ask you this question so I get the quote for my story.
It's not what you do, it's why you do it.
Yes, exactly.
Linda, thank you so much. What a wonderful time together.
Julie, I think that many people must think of you and maybe me as a complimentary mentor, but they usually mean it more as in all the nice things we say about our mentees, where Linda educated us on the power of having a mentor that has a complementary skill set to you and how that can really bring the best out of you and the relationship with your mentor.
And sometimes that takes work. It's sometimes easier to just try to find somebody who's just like you and try to see how you can make a better version of the version of yourself that you believe you are. But having those complementary skills not only helps you maybe see something in yourself that you didn't see, but it also helps you get further faster because you have somebody else who's got another skill, like the front of the boat and the back of the boat.
Totally. And you don't have to then force the puzzle pieces to match in that way. I think it requires a next level ability of being humble and being aware of your vulnerabilities or where you might feel you're vulnerable. But the power of connection is very, very strong. And I thought Linda said it really well.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, I love her optimism. As you heard in the podcast, she is my neighbor. So I certainly went to her book.
Shout out Brooklyn.
Shout out Brooklyn. Shout out 2nd Street between 5th and 6th. She was...
Okay, Julie's doxed herself.
As you heard on the podcast, Linda is not only an amazing podcast guest, she is also my neighbor. And I had the chance to go to her book launch, and her book deals with complicated, sad, epic, stressful situations that people go through around health and racism. And she was so optimistic as she's presenting about the book, as she's talking about like the heartache that people saw, but the amazing experiences they had and how they showed up for each other in these communities. And I feel like I really heard that on the podcast today. Everything from, you know, racism in the healthcare system to journalism and like the future careers that these potential journalists have. She's like, let's just, you know, we're going to be optimistic here.
I took away from Linda's optimism that how special is it and how can we not be hopeful if people who have been in such terrible situations where they were not set up for success, where the system was against them, and yet they were still strong enough to share their story with somebody like Linda, asking Linda to then put her power and her energy behind it to then share that story with the world. I mean, that's without that illumination, how will we get anything done? How will there be progress? So Linda is giving us hope for progress. And, you know, that's why I was like, she's got to be optimistic that way because she's given hope.
100%. And I just think about journalism as a whole and the depth that is needed to embed into these communities to really be able to authentically share their stories. And I know budgets get cut and, you know, things are all about ChatGPT, but I really hope these kind of stories that are, you know, the kind of stories that Linda works on continue to get shared because they're really, really meaningful.
Amen to that. And Linda gives some great practical tips on how to share space and how to be together and join in a new community. Her quote, where she made it seem so easy to just walk into a brand new community, like down in New Orleans, not knowing anybody, and saying to somebody, can you drive me around? Can I see the community through your eyes? And I'm sure there was some, you know, background and some, you know, trust building before that question, but that's a big loaded question to ask somebody to share something so personal as their space, which they occupy, and others that they care about, and allow you to see it through their eyes. It's really a powerful question. And I think a wonderful way for mentees and mentors to give each other wonderful context at why their perspective is such a way. And it's like, hey, like, okay, you gave me this anecdote. Why were you seeing it this way? Or even like, what were you doing earlier that week or earlier that year that made you think about it in this way? Like literally, like, can you drive me around? Tell me through your eyes. Give me some background.
I think the whole conversation we had with Linda, the thing I kept thinking over and over again is this episode is brought to you by connection. one of our augmenters principals. I think Linda is the ultimate. We've had many guests who have had deep connections, but I feel like Linda embodies and nails the augmenters principle of connection. If we had a connection award, I would walk down to her house and give it to her.
Connection award. I feel like that's something that like Comcast would like to receive. Never actually.
We can make that suggestion. But yeah, it was a great episode. It was
and really I have fun. To give a shout out to Linda and her wonderful heuristic for problem solving. As you know, Julie, I like to describe myself as a truffle pig for problems. So
is that why you hang out with me?
No, you're not the problem. You're not the truffle. Not at all. No. Her process was amazing. It was recognize the problem, then look at the data, then ask people to tell me about the problem, then frame the problem objectively and go back to the data. And it was, you know, it reinforced the importance of data. It reinforced to me that if you're going to have systemic change, you really need to have not just your feelings behind something, but the feelings of others. That's the data going into it. And you got to have a process if you're going to do something over and over and over again and do it well. And Linda showed her process for illuminating grand structural problems. And it's simple. It's just 5 steps. Just, I don't want to do this every day.
Well, it sounds like she was a mentor to you, Jimmy.
Oh, yeah. How do you inspire young journalists? Have them read something that Linda wrote and then listen to an Augmenters podcast with Linda.
Check, check. No, it was great. It was really, it was a wonderful, wonderful episode. I look forward to seeing all the mentees of Linda as they continue to evolve in this crazy world.
And next time I write something for Augmenters, I'm going to take Linda's advice, which is think visually, think cinematically, write that way. I'm not going to do a good job, but I'm going to try.
Hashtag goals.
Hashtag goals. Augmenters out.
Augmenters out. Wow, you've made it this far, and we thank you. Hopefully you enjoyed our episode and discovered new ways to bring more authentic connection into your mentoring relationships. Want to tell them more, Jimmy?
Be an augmenter with us. Visit our website for the best interactive mentoring content at augmenters.us. Share our podcast with someone you care about. Like and subscribe. And yes, really, you following our show and writing a review, it's a big deal. Your actions provide us with the resources to continue our undefeated, unencumbered, prize-winning productions. We welcome questions and suggestions via email hi@augmenters.us or on social with our handle @augmentershq. We are most active and available on LinkedIn and YouTube. Shout out and earnest thank you to our intrepid producer, Erlen Cato. We appreciate you. Augmenters out.
See ya.